Now, I know we have some folks here, guys and gals, that are in whatever your business is or whatever your, you know, whatever your duties are. It involves troubleshooting. Now, if that's a foreign term to you, I'll explain it a little bit. Troubleshooting, we'll take your car, for example. You know, you're riding along and all of a sudden there's a... Or you hear a sound, you know, or you go, what is that? By the way, why is it that my car only breaks down when my wife is driving it? My car will run like a clock for 10 years, and then she drives it once, and she comes in, the car's making a funny sound. There's a funny smell. I don't know what it is. Sounds like something's burning. I don't know. But anyway, you know what I'm talking about. There's something happens. There's a smell. There's a sound. It's doing something funny. And so, you know, and this is kind of a guy thing, although it doesn't have to be. What do? You look under the hood, right? And you're looking for wires that have come loose or fluid where it doesn't belong, you know, like on the ground. And you're trying to figure, what's that smell? Where's that coming from? Is everything in its place? You'll start it up. I mean, listen, is it going tick, 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 tick? Or is it going talk, 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 talk? You know, and over on this side, is that going? Is the water pump moving? Are the fan belts all in place? Are all the things turning? And, you know, and that's just what you do. And there's a process to that. And we've all done it, whether you realize it or not. There's three parts to it. You examine the symptoms, right? You take a look and listen. You identify the problem, and then you apply the fix, right? We do that with our cars. Whether you're working on your car, whether you're working on your computer, it's always the same three-part, three-step process. Examine the symptoms, identify the problem, apply the cure. Now, do you realize that's exactly what your doctor does? You know, the first part they call an examination. You go, doc, I got this pain or this ache or this problem. And so they're listening here and, you know, inhale, exhale, poke. Does this hurt? Does that hurt? Let me look up your nose and down your throat and in your ears. And they do this examination. Then they come up with a diagnosis. They determine the problem. Well, you've got, you know... no thyroid, basically. It was a problem I had a few weeks ago. And they determine the problem, and then they apply or they prescribe the cure. It might be some kind of physical therapy. It might be medication. In some cases, it might even be a surgical solution. But that three-part process, examination, diagnosis, prescription. Examine the problem, or examine the symptoms, determine the problem, and then apply the cure. You know, when your car is out of whack, mechanically, that's what you do. Well, sometimes we are out of whack spiritually, and we need to troubleshoot our lives. We need to go through that same process. You know, you just don't feel right for some reason. You feel kind of uptight, maybe, or troubled, or depressed, or discouraged. You know, something's... maybe you're not making a funny sound, and hopefully you're not making a funny smell, but there's something wrong, and you can tell, you can sense that, you know, and life suddenly has become a burden, where it used to be kind of a, you know, a fun thing, a good thing, and you feel like you're under some kind of pressure. You know what I'm talking about? I think you do. In this fourth chapter of James, the first 10 verses, we learn how faith works under pressure. And while this passage does deal with a very specific situation, it also gives us some general principles to follow when we need to troubleshoot our lives, when our lives are under pressure. Let's read the first three verses and we'll go from there. He says, where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you don't have because you don't ask. You ask and don't receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. Okay. Faith that works under pressure, first of all, knows how to examine the symptoms. And in this case, the symptoms are the war within. I think in the NIV, that might be what verse 1 says, a pleasure that the war within. He says here, the pleasures that war in your members. Here's what James is telling us, first of all. The battles on the inside, or battles on the outside, I should say, reveal a battle on the inside. See, what's going on out here kind of gives away what's going on inside here. He talks about wars and fights. Now, that pretty much covers it all. You know, wars, the word wars here describes the kind of ongoing chronic condition, whereas the word fights refers to those specific little skirmishes, you know, that happen within the war. And it says here they're going on. The wars and fights come from among you, that is, from among the believers. It kind of reminds me of as we went through 1 Corinthians. Well, I follow Paul. Well, I follow Apollos. And people are splitting up into little cliques and clubs about who's the best teacher or who makes the best chili or whatever. And they're just kind of picking and pecking at each other. And that's what goes on, is going on here, apparently. And James, you know, says, in a sense, he's asking, how can born-again, spirit-filled people have wars and fights? I mean, that's the symptom. You're warring, you're fighting with one another, and here you are, all saved from the same eternity without God for an eternity with God. You've all been filled with God's Spirit. You've been given, as it says in the first part of Ephesians, every blessing under heaven. How is it possible? I wonder if James kind of scratches his head, you know. How is it even possible that you folks, God's people, are warring and fighting with one another? And he says that's the symptom. And his question is, where do they come from? Well, they come from your desires for pleasure. That's what he says. He's talking about those earthly, sensual pleasures. In the context of 1 Corinthians, Paul called it carnality, from that word carnal, which literally means meat. It's that base animal nature, that inherently selfish nature that is part and parcel of our flesh. It's what we're saved from, but it's what dogs us every day of our lives until we escape these physical, you know, tents that we live in. Sometimes they're called the appetites of the flesh, these desires, your desires for pleasure, he calls it. Some of those desires are physical. And in this case, you know, as it would be sometimes even something that we might think is as silly, but you know, you'd be amazed at what people will fight over. Well, maybe you wouldn't. But in this case, it might even be the best food. You know, who gets the best cut of steak and who gets that big, you know, piece of fat that they cut off when you're at the end of the line. Again, it reminds me of that 1 Corinthians story. He goes, when you guys have, you know, the Lord's Supper, it's not the Lord's Supper, because one eats, one goes hungry, one gets drunk. You're pushing and shoving, trying to get to the front of the line. Some people want to sit in a special place. Some people have to sit outside, but you know, with the chickens. And there's just this kind of silliness going on. But part of this is all physical. The desire for the best food could be the desire for the softest chair. You know, you'd just be surprised when somebody gets to sit on that, you know, we're talking first century here, handmade, you know, stuffed with chicken feathers or lamb's wool, kind of cushy chair versus the one that gets to sit on the rock or the stump, and there becomes this kind of, you know, and that just festers and builds up, and we laugh because it is a stupid thing to fight over, but that's what's going on here. And that's, you know, we maybe don't get in a fuss over who sits in what chair. It could be who gets to sit by the fire when it's cold out, or who gets to sit by the window and gets that breeze when it's hot out. Just these physical, you know, the desire, the demand really for physical comfort. Then there are social aspects to this desire for pleasure. You know, the desire to be right. The desire to get your own way. I worked for a fella in Nashville who, no matter what, he was right. And if there was a disagreement and he was wrong, then he would argue and argue and argue until somehow he had twisted himself around to be right and say, yeah, I was right all along. Well, no, wait a minute. You said up and now you're saying down. Well, I meant down, you know, just that desire, that demand to be right all the time, to get your own way so that you fit in where you want in the society of things. There are emotional desires, the desire to feel better about yourself or the desire to be seen in a certain light, to be esteemed by other people so that their opinion of you is the basis for how you feel about yourself. Those earthly sensual desires. And he says they're in your members, which is kind of a funny word. You know, it fits better than intended. You know, in a church context, now we don't have members formally, but we do. If you come and are a part of this family, you are a member. You just don't have to sign anything or promise anything to be a member. And that really does fit, you know, among your members. Now, the word literally means limbs. He's usually using the picture of a body, you know, and again, it ties in with Paul's writing about the body of Christ. There's an arm and a leg and a head and an ear and a toenail and this and that and all those pieces. And he thinks of the church as a body. And among the members, there's this fuss. There are these earthly desires. Now, what he's talking about in this case is the real you, that inner you, the you that you know is you, no matter what you're presenting or no matter what anybody else thinks on the outside, the real you. That's where the war is going on. See, he's talking about the symptoms here, that being under pressure. Where do the wars and fights come from? They come from the inside. They come from your desire for pleasure, those things that war on the inside. The battle on the outside reveals the battle on the inside. Now, the battle on the inside, as he started to touch on here, is all about unfulfilled cravings. Verse 2, you lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you don't ask. Pretty strong language here. You lust, you murder, you covet. Now realize that James, as Jesus' younger brother, as he does here, or he does here, as he does several times in this little letter, he refers to things that Jesus talked about in the Sermon on the Mount. Remember that? You've heard it said, don't commit adultery, but I tell you that if you even lust after lust in your heart, you've committed adultery. You've heard it said, don't murder, but if you hate someone, if you're angry in your heart, you've committed murder already. So it's not that these people were stabbing each other, you know, killing each other for the big piece of chicken, you know, at the potluck, literally, but they had that kind of, that was their heart problem. They were craving and coveting and hating and giving in to that kind of fleshly mindset, and it was expressing itself in these wars and battles. And see, James's concern here is for the condition of the heart. It should be our concern. It's the Lord's concern, the condition of the heart. You know, again, the Lord isn't so concerned. The Lord doesn't want you to pretend to not be so angry you could kill somebody. It doesn't say, you know, thou shalt not let it show. What he's talking about is having such a change from that born-again, spirit-filled experience that hate is not a part of who you are. That physical lust, sexual lust, isn't a part of who you are anymore. And that's kind of what James is looking back on here. You lust and you don't have. You murder and covet and can't obtain. See, he's using these strong words to make us realize the seriousness of this sin. See, we might think we're just a little bent out of shape with somebody in the church. Well, they parked in my parking place. I left, you know, that bowl of soup in the fridge downstairs, and now it's gone, and I know who took it. And it was mine, you know, kind of thing. That's what James is concerned about, and he uses these strong... I mean, you don't think, when you get mad at somebody for taking your soup, you don't consider yourself a murderer. But that's what James wants us to see. When we're angry at one another, when we're craving and coveting, and the lust doesn't just have to be sexual, it's just any kind of physical craving. He wants us to see how serious it is, so he lumps them all at that far end of the spectrum with lust and murder and coveting. He says it's bad enough for the world to live that way, but God's people to war and fight with one another over this, to have this kind of heart attitude towards one another. He doesn't say it, but what's implied here is shame on you. Shame on you, people. And he writes this, you know, to believers, to we learned that back in chapter 1 from the Jewish Christians that were scattered out of Jerusalem because of Roman persecution. And really, it's a letter to the church everywhere and to our church today. And the implication here is shame on you people. How can you be murderers? Well, I'm not a murderer, but you hate in your heart. You know, shame on you for coveting. Well, I don't covet. Shame on you for, well, yeah, we do. He wants us to realize that. He says you don't have because you don't ask. Here you are, you're craving all this stuff and you're getting worked up and bent out of shape. I want what you've got. I want this and I want that. I want my way. I want everybody to think I'm the big kahuna or the nicest or the richest or the most generous. You know, it's like I want everybody to think I'm the most humble. Is that a contradiction in terms or what? You know? I'm going to manipulate things so everybody will think I'm just humble as all get out. He says you don't have these things because you don't ask. Now, there's a couple of reasons he's going to get to, but you don't ask. What does he mean by that? Well, when you ask the Lord for things, isn't that usually in the context of prayer? That's kind of what that means. And so what he's saying here in a roundabout way is that you folks are so concerned about getting what you want that you're not spending time just seeking the Lord daily. You're not constantly in prayer the way that you ought to be. You don't have because you don't ask. See, when you're caught up in the flesh, you don't pray. Now, you can look back over your life and probably see that. I sure can. There are times when I get caught up in something other than the things of the Lord, and before I know it, days, weeks, time goes by, and I realize I haven't really spent any time with the Lord at all. Now, the opposite is also true, though. When I do spend time with the Lord, when I make that a priority, then I find that I don't get caught up in the things of the world. It's like a double-edged sword. It cuts both ways. He says, you don't ask. Or you don't have, I mean, because you don't ask. You've broken communication. You've disconnected from the Lord. And so, of course, you're not going to be fulfilled. And what else? If you're not fulfilled spiritually, there's only one other option. That's the flesh. So if I'm not walking with the Lord, if I'm not experiencing the presence of the Lord, if I'm not filled with the Spirit and spending time with the Lord, then I'm going to look the only other place I can to find satisfaction, which is the desires of the flesh, whatever that might be. These cravings go unfulfilled. He says, you don't have because you don't ask. And then in verse 3, he talks about when you do ask, your motives are wrong. Read it. You ask and you don't receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasure. You know, either you don't have because you don't ask because you're not really walking with the Lord in the first place, or when you do ask, you don't get what you ask for because you're asking with the wrong motive. You're asking selfishly. Now, that kind of makes sense if you think about it. I mean, not many of us are bold enough to pray selfishly. At least not on purpose, not regularly. You know, we don't ask the Lord for those things because we kind of know better. Or because we're kind of ashamed of ourselves for being so selfish. It's like, our Father who art in heaven, I pray for, you know, healing for that one who's suffering. And I pray for world peace. Oh, and I'd also like the soft chair by the fire. Usually we don't go there. And that's what he's saying. You don't have because you don't ask. And when you do ask, you don't receive because you ask amiss. You know, the longer you let your life be driven by the pursuit of pleasure, the bigger the battle within you becomes. And the greater the pressure you're under. So, once you've examined the symptoms, the pressure, the wars, the fights, the picking, the depression, the dissatisfaction and all that, once you examine those symptoms, the next step in this troubleshooting is that you've got to determine the cause. I examine the symptoms, then I determine the cause, which James here calls spiritual adultery or spiritual unfaithfulness. Again, see, James uses some pretty strong language. We usually don't take things this seriously. And that's part of the lesson of this passage. James says, you know, there's no such thing as a small sin. You know, there's no such, it's like a little white lie. No, it's a lie. And there's no such thing as a small sin. Sin is sin. So he says the cause of this war within, the cause of this pressure, kind of anxiety feeling that you are experiencing, is spiritual unfaithfulness. Verse 4, adulterers and adulteresses, he calls them. Covering, you know, both bases. Actually, I read this week that it's strongly thought that originally it just said adulteresses, but that the later scribes didn't want people to get the idea he was only addressing women, so they added the adulterers. But really, adulteresses fits because we are the bride of Christ, and the church is called the bride throughout the New Testament. So that's part of it. You adulterers and adulteresses, don't you know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Here's what he's saying. When you're better friends with the world than you are with the Lord, that's spiritual adultery. That's spiritual unfaithfulness. Again, strong language, but he wants us to see the seriousness of our sin. And we have to examine ourselves. Who do you look to for fulfillment? Who do you look to for comfort? Who do you look for protection? Do you look to the world or do you look to the Lord? Who do you, or what do you celebrate? What do you rejoice in? What do you delight in? The things of the world or the things of the Lord? He says, man, when you're better friends with the world than you are with the Lord, that's spiritual adultery. I heard a guy, James Robeson, I think is how you say it, one of those TV guys, flipping through the channels several years ago now. And he said the most interesting thing. He said, Jesus is not coming back for a prostitute bride. That hurts. Now, as a pastor, I've had the, I wouldn't call it a privilege, I've had the duty to counsel couples where there's been adultery in the relationship. Let me tell you, it's never easy. It's never pretty. Even the ones that take it well and deal with it appropriately are nightmares. And then it just gets worse from there, how the individuals deal with it and how the couple deals with it. And when I put my walk with the Lord in that context, an adulterer, you know, better friends with the world. The bride of Christ should not be dating. You know, we shouldn't be flirting with the world. We have a bridegroom. We have a husband. We have someone that we've pledged our faithfulness to and whose faithfulness to us is unquestionable. In verse 5, he tells us, see, that the Lord aches to be your best friend. Here we are, here they were, making friends with the world, committing spiritual adultery by looking to the world for comfort, protection, you know, self-esteem, fulfillment, gratification, every other thing. And at the same time, verse 5 tells us, or do you think that the scripture says in vain, the spirit who dwells in us yearns jealousy? See, he's telling these people, James is telling these people, you're in the middle of this spiritual adultery, this unfaithfulness to the Lord, your bridegroom who gave his life, as it says in Ephesians, to make you spotless and without blemish, and you're friends with the world, and you don't realize that all the time the Lord just aches to be your best friend. The Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously. Now we have to understand that word jealousy or jealously a little bit. It's not the kind of jealousy that we experience. Now maybe you've been jealous, or maybe you're, you know, spouse or boyfriend, girlfriend, whoever has been jealous. See, that's not a good thing, isn't it? In 1 Corinthians 13, one of the things that love is not is jealous. See, our fleshly human jealousy is based on fear and insecurity. And boy, I can remember, you know, when I first met Mary, and I just couldn't believe that, you know, that the most beautiful girl in the world would have anything to do with a slob like me. And anytime some other guy looked at her sideways, I just went into total freak out panic mode. Oh no, once she sees him, once she gets a look at how handsome he is, once she sees how funny he is, once she learns how smart he is, once she sees what a great guy he is, she's going to leave me in the dust. And so I would freak out and panic and get at him. And you know, it was just kind of jealous, frightened deal. Just let me tell you, that's not healthy. And I don't know how many young folks, you know, we have here of the sort of the junior high school, or, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, looking for that special one age. But if you ever find yourself feeling that kind of jealousy toward the boyfriend, girlfriend, that ain't love. And if you have to live in the constant fear that he or she is going to leave you in the dust, then why don't you just leave them in the dust? Let me just save you some heartache and heartbreak right there, because that's not love. If you have to worry about someone's faithfulness to you, that's not the kind of relationship you want to be in. Well, that's exactly what the Lord feels towards us. If he has to worry about our faithfulness to him, what kind of relationship is that? What does that say? Now, the Lord's jealousy that he talks about here isn't that kind of fearful, insecure jealousy. It's how much he loves you and how much he values you. And when he sees you, it's kind of, you know, the book of Hosea. Remember that one? Of course, we've all read Hosea last week, right? Several times. The Lord tells Hosea, I want you to marry this gal named Gomer. Just makes me laugh, you know, we can't help it, Gomer. And by the way, she's a prostitute, but I want to illustrate the fact that I'm going to marry Israel, my bride, even though she's unfaithful to me. And so he marries her, and yeah, and boy, she, next thing you know, she packs up and goes back out on the street. She's a hooker, and she wants to be a hooker. She doesn't appreciate being given a life or taken as a bride and all that, you know, provision that comes with it. And the Lord says, Hosea, go get her and bring her back home. But Lord, she's been unfaithful. He goes, yeah, believe me, I know. The Lord is a husband who knows what unfaithfulness is like, but he sends him, Hosea, back again and again to bring Gomer back home, just to illustrate his love for us. The kind of jealousy the Lord has, see, he aches to be our best friend, but it doesn't wreck the relationship. His love is stronger than that. Remember, it's Romans 5:8. It said, while we were still sinners, Jesus died for us. Not after we stopped sinning, after we cleaned up our act. While we were still an unfaithful bride, our bridegroom gave his life to save us, to bring us to himself, to keep us to himself. That's how much he loves you. That's how badly he wants a relationship with you. That's how great his concern is for you. And the Spirit yearns jealously when he watches us, God's people, become best friends with the world, when all he wants is he wants to be our best friend. I heard this story, and it was told to me, represented as being true. Now, it sounds like a story, and I can't vouch for the authenticity, but I was told that it was factual. And maybe you can relate to this, and it relates to this idea of the Lord's jealousy or the Lord aching to be our best friend. The old, it wasn't that old, but a farmer had a wife and a little girl. And the wife and the little girl loved the Lord. They were faithful, you know, church goers. And, of course, the daughter was always going, Daddy, please come to church with us. No, I don't want to go down to that. They don't like me, and I don't like them, and I don't want anything to do with that bunch of hypocrites anyway, you know, the sort of standard line. But Daddy, you know, Jesus loves you and died for you. Yeah, I know all that. In fact, maybe I might even believe it, but I'm not going down there. I don't want to be a part of that scene. Just you guys go ahead, leave me out of it. And this would go on Sunday after Sunday, year after year after year. Well, one season, maybe it was around Easter, I can't remember. Maybe it was Christmas, but I think it was in the spring, so Easter's more likely. It's Sunday morning, and the wife and the daughter get up. Oh, Daddy, will you go to church with us? No, I'm not going down there. I don't like them, and they don't like me, and I don't want anything to do with that place. And so they go off to church, and the farmer, he's been out doing the morning chores, and it was kind of getting kind of cold out, so he had shut the barn door, and he was sitting at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee. The family had just left, and he can see out the window, out the back window, that these barn swallows are flying down and kind of buzzing the door. And they fly down and kind of buzz the door. And it occurs to him, you know, their nest is in the barn, and I've shut the door. I've shut them out of their barn. So out of their nest. And so he's kind of, you know, understands animals. So he puts his boots back on and his coat back on, and he goes out. But it is kind of windy and kind of cold, and he's trying to keep, you know, whatever animals are in the barn comfortable. So he cracks the door, you know, about that much, thinking the birds will fly in. And he goes back in and he sits back down at the table. And still, these barn swallows just kind of buzz the door almost, but no, they won't go in. And they fly away and they come back. And it looks like, oh, no, they won't go in. And he's going, oh, those dumb birds. So he puts his boots back on, pulls his coat on, goes out to the barn, and he throws the door wide open. There! You know, is that, are you happy now? And he goes back in and he sits down still for some reason. They'll buzz the door, and they almost go in, but they won't go in. And he's thinking, what is wrong with these birds? And so now he's getting kind of, you know, now he's made up his mind. These birds are going in that barn. And so he pulls his boots on and puts his coat on. Now he's got a broom, and he's chasing them out of the trees, trying to herd them, you know, into the barn. That's not going to work. Oh, you stupid birds. And so he goes back, and he sits down, and he's watching them. I mean, it's cold out there, and they've got to get in there to where their safety is, where their nest is. But he's tried everything he could think of to do, and it occurred to him, you know, maybe if I could become a barn swallow and fly in there first and say, see, it's safe, maybe then the birds would be okay. And that's when it hit him. That's what God did for me. He became a man to show me how to find my way to safety, to where I really want to be all along. And it just changed his life. It changed his perspective. See, that's what the Lord has done. He became one of us to show us how to get to where we want to be, how to get to that safe place. And but then he sees us and we'd rather be friends with the world. We'd rather pursue selfish things, which lead to the fighting and the bickering amongst ourselves, and we're supposed to be God's born-again, spirit-filled people. It just breaks his heart, and the spirit yearns jealously for our affection, for our attention, for our devotion. The good news is, because of God's grace, it's never too late to turn back to him. Look at verse 6, right after he says, the Spirit dwells jealous or yearns jealously, but he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Just by the way, note here, you Bible students, that in verses 5 and 6, James is teaching a little Bible study here. He's referred to a couple of Old Testament verses. He's exegeting. He's, you know, inductively studying and getting to the heart of God's word. I thought that was an interesting observation. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Here's the lesson. Pride is the one thing that can keep you from God's grace. I don't know if I can say it's the only thing, but man, it's sure one thing that can. There's a stubbornness associated with pride, especially human pride. You know, I have every right to expect the soft chair by the fire. You know, I've earned the privilege. I deserve to be first in line. Or you know, everybody should agree with me. I shouldn't have to put up with those, you know, disagreeable, difficult people. I mean, don't they know who I am? Yeah, they do. That's probably the problem. You know, don't you know who you are? That's the solution to the thing. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. See, if you come to the Lord in humility, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, if you come to the Lord in humility, there's always more grace and more grace and more grace, inexhaustible grace, if we come to him with humility. So, having examined the symptoms, the battles and fights, the wars that go on, that outward battle that expresses the inward battle, and having determined the cause, selfish pleasure seeking, and a friendship with the world that is greater and more important than friendship with the Lord, the only thing left then is to apply the surrender. And he identifies that cure, or apply the cure. He identifies that cure as surrender. First, he tells us, surrender your will. Verse 7, therefore submit to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Now, got to remember, what does submission mean? Submission is cooperation based on trust. Cooperate with the Lord. It's the backside of resist. Cooperate with the Lord. Resist the enemy. Resist the enemy and he will flee. That's one of the greatest promises in the whole Bible. It doesn't say go to battle with the enemy and defeat him, crush him, vanquish him. It just says resist him. You know why? Because he wants to take out the easy ones. He's like a lion seeking whom he may devour. Well, you watch enough, you know, enough Animal Planet or National Geographic or whatever, those Wild Kingdom, and you come to find out that lions by nature are kind of lazy. And they don't pick out the biggest, strongest animal in the herd and then go, you know, chase them down and catch them. No, they look for the weak one, the sickly one, the straggler, the one with the bad leg or whatever. And because, you know, if they go chasing after the strongest one in the herd, you know, how lions, they take off and it looks so so cool. They're just sleek and they're running. And then, but if it's not an easy catch, they kind of just, forget it. You know? But that little one might be a young one. And maybe it got a, you know, sprained ankle and it's kind of walking like this. And the lion goes, and then they run up and they get it and they devour it. Just a little bit of resistance. And the enemy says, oh, forget it. I'll get the easy one. Cooperate with the Lord. See, surrender your will. Not what I want, Lord, but what you want. That's how I solve this problem. That's how I get out of this pressure that I'm under. I just trust the Lord. I surrender my will. And then the second thing, you surrender your full attention. Verse 8, he says, draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. Draw near to God. Give him your full attention. You know, that doesn't need a whole lot of explanation. He says, cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. That clean hands has to do with the outside. Cleanse your hands. Don't touch the sin. Don't defile or soil yourselves by coming into contact with sin. And then the next part of that verse, purify your hearts, has to do with the inward. You know, don't touch sin with a 10-foot pole on the outside. Don't get your hands dirty with it. And then don't let sin in. Don't let it defile your heart. Purify your heart. Have clean hands. He calls the people, he calls us, I should say, you double-minded. See, we want it both ways. I want to live like hell and then experience heaven when I'm in the mood. I want to do what I want to do. I want to satisfy my desires. I want to do, if it feels good, do it, man. And I'm going for it. But then when I'm in the mood, it's, oh, Lordeth, I worshipeth thee. And I want to be, you know, Mr. Religion. So you double-minded. You know, James already used that term, double-minded, once, already back in chapter 1, verse 8. Let not that man, that is the man who doubts, suppose he'll receive anything from the Lord, for he's double-minded. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. You can't live with one foot in the world and one foot in the kingdom. I suppose you can try. And maybe if you're on the way from the world to the kingdom, there might be that minute where you're kind of in the middle, but you can't stay there. You know, that old song, you can stand with one foot on the platform and one foot on the train. But when the train starts to move, you've got a decision to make. Otherwise, you do the splits big time. That double-minded, you know, cleanse your hands. You know, if you're spiritually minded, then don't come in contact with these things, because again, there's the symptoms, the wars, there's the cause, that selfishness, and the cure is surrender your full attention to God. Draw near to God, and He'll draw near to you. That's another great promise, boy. And James has a few of them here in this last section. Surrender your will, surrender your full attention, surrender your emotions, verse 9, lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Now here's what he's not telling us. He's not telling us that there's great spiritual value in being a sourpuss. If we just all walked around going, I can't believe him. You know, that the Lord just is thrilled. His heart is thrilled by that. What he is telling us is this. Allow yourself to experience the fullness of genuine contrition. Recognize the seriousness of the sin. He says, you're not just a little ticked off, you're a murderer. You're not just a little selfish, you're lusting and coveting. You're not just a little unfaithful to the Lord, you're an adulterer and an adulteress. Let that reality take, you know, surrender yourself to the reality of that and let genuine contrition run its course. Now, the word contrition or contrite isn't in this passage, but that's what he's getting at, you know, lament, mourn, and weep. It's, again, from the Sermon on the Mount, James's big brother. You know, James probably heard him give that that Bible study many, many, many times over those 3 or so years. And Jesus said, blessed are those who mourn, for they'll be comforted. Well, blessed are those who mourn what? Blessed are those who mourn the loss of fellowship that sin brings into our lives. Blessed are those who really grieve that loss of fellowship. When Jesus hung on the cross and said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, if we really recognize the depth of the sin and the unfaithfulness and the adultery, we're also going to experience that forsakenness, because where God is, sin can't coexist and the spirit is grieved. And so he's telling us here, don't just put on the pretense of grief, but he says, you know, recognize the harm that's done, I guess would be another way to say it. True contrition. That word contrite, of course, means pulverized. A broken spirit, a contrite heart. A heart that is ground under the grinding wheel, under the pressure of our own sin, so that we turn ourselves over to the Lord. Surrender your will, surrender your attention, surrender your emotions. Lastly, he says, surrender your pride. Verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord and he will lift you up. Humble yourself before the Lord. Let me just define that this way. Humility. Know who you are without God and with God. Know who you are, know who the Lord is, and then let that knowledge make you comfortable in your own skin. That's humility. I know who I am. I'm just an old sinner, but I'm saved by grace. Who's the Lord? The compassionate. Showing mercy to thousands. The one who gave his life to set me free from the bondage to sin. I know who I am. I know who he is. And when all of that truth really takes root in my life, I become comfortable in my own skin. You know, I'm a little bigger around the middle than I'd like to be. My mind gets a little tangled up, a lot more, actually, than I would like it to. But God made me who I am, and he loves me. Now, who am I to not be okay with that? So I've got to learn to be comfortable in my own skin. I've got to say, Lord, I may weigh 50 pounds more than I want to, or my nose may be bigger or smaller, or I wish I had red hair and I'm stuck with this brown stuff, whatever, the fill in your own blank. But then you have to come to that point where you go, you know what? God made me who I am. He made me the way I am. And when I know who I am and I know who he is, I've just got to learn to be okay with that and be comfortable in my own skin. That's what he means when he says, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. Don't think more of yourself, but don't think less of yourself. Just be comfortable with who you are. And then, it says, he will lift you up. Another incredibly great promise. Faith that works under pressure, goes to work, examines the symptoms, what's causing this pressure, identifies the cause, you know, diagnoses the problem, and then applies the cure, which is surrender. Now, there is such a thing, I've heard it called holy discontent. And that's kind of a good pressure. It's when I'm not the disciple I really want to be. That's the kind of pressure that pushes me towards God. I'm not as loving as I want to be. I'm not as patient as I'd like to be. You know, I'm not as surrendered to the life of the Lord flowing up through me, in me, and out of me as I'd like to be. That's a holy discontent. That's a good pressure. That's the kind of pressure that drives us to surrender ourselves more and more to the Lord. But if you find yourself under that other pressure, that dissatisfaction that comes from not getting what you want in the world or from other people, or not getting your own way because you think that you ought to, because you're you after all, you know, then there's this troubleshooting process. God did not give us life that we would live under a burden of pressure. He gave us life that we would roll our cares over onto the Lord, and that we would move beyond that selfishness and the wars and the fightings and friendship with the world. And we move into finding what we can only find when we really determine ourselves to connect with and stay connected with the Lord. That's what he wants for us, and that's what James is getting at here. He's pretty harsh about it, but that's because he wants us to see how serious sin is.